Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. The existence of the human soul is usually described as a matter of faith, unprovable by science. But is that true? What if evidence exists that we each do indeed have souls, and that life continues after death? Whether we have souls and what happens to us after death, obliteration, reincarnation, heaven, hell, is a question we humans have obsessed about for as long as we have records of our existence. Indeed, it may be the ultimate question. For as a suicidal Hamlet laments in Shakespeare's most immortal soliloquy, to die, to sleep, perchance to dream, eh, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. All right, Olivia, I am not, but that is the question that human beings have been asking themselves for time immemorial. My guests on today's program attempt to answer those eternal questions in their new book, The Immortal Mind, which argues both that there is scientific data demonstrating the immaterial existence of the human person and that this reality continues after we die. Award-winning brain surgeon Michael Egnor is a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics and neurosurgery residence director at the Renaissance School of Medicine in Stony Brook. He was named one of New York's best doctors by the New York Magazine in 2005. He received his medical education at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and completed his residency at Jackson Memorial Hospital. He is on the scientific advisory board of the Hydrocephalus Association in the United States and has lectured extensively throughout the United States and Europe. He is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence, making his second appearance on this podcast. Denise O'Leary is the author or co-author of several books on the topic of science, creation, design, and spirituality, including co-authoring The Spiritual Brain. She received her degree in Honors English Language and Literature. She has published regularly in the Discovery Institute's Science and Culture Today and is the editor of Mind Matters. Michael and Denise, welcome to Humanize.
Thank you, Wesley.
Good to have you back, Michael, and hello, Denise. Michael, you're a brain surgeon. You write that being a surgeon, quote, seemed like the most intimate way to get to know what it is to be human and to unravel the mystery of life. That sounds almost mystical, but isn't medicine focused on the material aspects of the human body?
Well, certainly to some extent, yes, of course, we operate on the brain as an organ. What I think neurosurgery offers, and it's quite unique, actually, it's unique even as compared with neuroscience, is that neurosurgeons are the only people in the world who meet people usually before they have brain surgery. They do the brain surgery. They work directly with their brain. And then they get to know them after the surgery, too. So you have a kind of a complete view of the connection between the mind and the brain as a neurosurgeon that no other doctor has and no other scientist has. The greatest neuroscientists in the world, for the most part, have never seen a living human brain, let alone operated on one. So you're really in a front row seat in neurosurgery, and that kind of fascinated me.
And you're seeing the brain as it's functioning, not in terms of like dissecting what it's parts are, but you see it in actual action when you're performing surgery, right?
Yes. And I mean, we see the whole picture. That is that before surgery, we do a neurological examination on the patient. We establish a personal relationship with the patient. We do the surgery on their brain, and then postoperatively, we do a neurological exam and continue the personal relationship. So we really have a feel for that. And for some kinds of brain operations, I don't do this often, but I have done it, and other neurosurgeons do it more than I, where we do awake brain surgery, where the patient is actually awake during the operation. You can give local anesthesia in the scalp, and the brain feels no pain itself, so it's painless. And we can map the brain and determine if there are critical areas that need to be protected. So we can actually talk to patients and, in a sense, examine them neurologically while we're operating on their brains. So this is a front row seat.
This is a means, when you do that, of avoiding certain parts of the brain because you don't want to damage those parts?
Correct. The cerebral cortex, about roughly half of the cerebral cortex, has assigned to it critical functions that you can easily damage. The other half of the cerebral cortex does not have those critical functions, and you can remove portions of that cortex without really having any significant effect on a person. But you can't tell just by looking which part of the cortex is critical and which isn't. So if you really have to know, having a patient awake and gently stimulating the cortex, you can map the critical areas of the cortex and protect them during the surgery.
Denise, you're a prolific writer about science issues. How did you choose the writer's life, and why did you focus on scientific questions?
Well, I've always been a writer, so I'm not sure how I chose it. About the science question.
So what you're saying is you are a writer, and so a writer writes,
yes,
right?
Yes, essentially. Once you learn how to handle the pencil. But anyway, I got involved with science writing because of Dolly the sheep. Remember that cloned sheep?
Yes, I do.
I was writing for a Christian biweekly in Canada, and the editor wanted to know what was going on. And I said, well, I'll find out and write something for you. And I rather liked it. And then I said, would you like me to do something on transgenics? And he said, yes. So that developed into a column. And then for years and years, I just kept writing about science issues for anyone who would publish my work.
So you and Michael co-authored this. How do you work it? Do you write a first draft and go back and forth, comment back and forth until you come up with what you're satisfied with?
Roughly. Yes. That's the usual way. And then, of course, remember, editors weigh in, and yes, people they assign to other people get involved and so forth. So it's actually a much more collaborative project than some people might assume.
All right, your book claims that science and reason demonstrate that the human soul exists. So let's start there. What exactly do you mean by the human soul in the context of your book?
The human soul, we take a perspective that is basically Aristotelian and Thomistic, that is from Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas. And the soul, in our view, is not something mysterious or ghosty, or it's not a translucent thing that looks like you. And the soul is simply everything that's true about us that makes us alive. So my soul consists of my capacity to reason, my capacity to have free will, my ability to see, my ability to hear, my ability to speak, my heartbeat, my breathing, all of that together is my soul. And when I die, I don't do those living things, so my soul no longer is in my body. So that's the way we understand the soul. Certain aspects of the soul are what we moderns call the mind. That is,
yeah, I was going to get into that, because let me read the subtitle of your book. And that's why I was wondering if there was a distinction to be made. The name of the book is The Immortal Mind. The subtitle is A Neurosurgeon's Case for the Existence of the Soul. And I was going to ask you, since you brought it up, I'll ask it now. Do you see mind and soul as synonyms? And apparently you do not.
Correct. What we call mind is what the scholastic philosophers, and I think the scholastic philosophers basically got this right. I think we've kind of become confused as the centuries go by. What we call mind are simply certain powers of the soul. For example, one power of my soul is my ability to regulate my blood sugar. That's something that makes me alive. So my blood sugar is regulated properly. My ability to breathe is another part of my soul. We don't think of those as part of the mind, but they are parts of the soul. Also, I have
Let me interrupt you for a second, though. Those are also controlled by biological parts of the body, right?
Sure, absolutely.
So why do you need a soul, let's say, to have your diaphragm contract so that you can breathe when that's done from the brain?
Well, you don't need a soul. It's just that that is a soul, meaning that we're not saying the body is a machine that the soul is like grafted onto, like a ghost in a machine. What we're simply saying is that the body is a unitary thing. That is, the human person is one substance, one thing, and all of the things about the human person that make that human person alive constitute the soul. So okay. It's not so much that the body needs it; it's just that these things are the soul. That's how you define the soul.
And we'll get into this in more detail later. Your thesis, Denise, is that even when the biological functions that I guess Mike is saying the soul controls cease to work, the soul continues. Is that right?
Well, the human soul has immortal aspects. You see, one difficulty is that a few centuries ago, the idea people had of what a soul is changed. And this created a huge amount of confusion, which I know I struggled with when writing the book. The traditional idea of the soul and the body was, think of it as three parts. You have the body. The soul animates the body. It's the what makes a body alive. Not just a human body, a cat's body or a horse's body. They have a soul too, except it's not immortal. When what makes the animal alive is withdrawn, then there's just the body, and the soul dissipates. But the human soul has immortal elements that can't dissipate.
All right. That's an issue of faith for sure. It could be an issue of philosophy. Aristotle, was not a Christian. He precedes Christianity.
It's an issue of reason.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say so. So, other than faith and other than philosophy, what scientific data exists to demonstrate that thesis?
Well, first, there's a rather large industry out there of people trying to prove that chimpanzees think like people.
Yes, I know.
And of course they don't. And so I would ask, what's different? Well, what's different between the way a chimpanzee thinks and the way a human being thinks is an aspect of what makes the human soul immortal: reason and moral choice. These things don't die with the body. They're not material. So that's one thing. You can see for yourself what in the human being would be immortal. And second, Mike can talk much more about this than I can, but there's the issue of, just for example, yes, veridical near-death experiences, where people separated from their bodies actually find out things that turn out to be correct. But I'll turn it over to Mike now, because he's the philosopher.
And he's also the scientist. Mike, in terms of what Denise was saying, reason might suggest that we continue because of our rational thought processes. Philosophy might suggest that, and faith might suggest that, but does science suggest that?
Yes, and science points to it very strongly. The way that science points to it is severalfold. First, there are no intellectual seizures, meaning that there are many kinds of seizures that leave people awake during the process of seizures.
You're talking about an epileptic seizure.
Yes, yes. And Wilder Penfield was a neurosurgeon who was an excellent neuroscientist back in the 20th century, who first noted that there are only four different things that happen during seizures when a person is awake. One thing is movement. Sometimes you have uncontrollable movement of a limb. The second is some perception, like you see flashes of light or you smell something. The third would be that you have a memory. Sometimes there are rare seizures that actually cause memories to be evoked. And the fourth thing is strong emotions. But he pointed out that there are never any intellectual seizures. That is, that no one ever has a seizure where they think about calculus or think about mathematics or logic or God. And if you think about it, the very thing we're doing right here, right now, which is reasoning and concepts, never, ever shows up in a seizure. And Penfield said, well, that's really odd because much of our mental activity when we're awake is conceptual, but concepts never show up in seizures. And he said, well, the obvious reason for that would be if concepts don't come from the brain, if there's a spiritual soul and there's a spiritual part of human beings, and that spiritual part is not evoked by a seizure because seizures only evoke what's in the brain, and that's not in the brain. And he found the same thing, and I've seen the same thing myself, that seizures only evoke those four things, never intellectual content. He found the same thing when he stimulated the brain in awake brain surgery, and I found the same thing, that you can stimulate movement, you can stimulate perception, you can stimulate memory, and you can stimulate emotion, but you can't stimulate abstract thought. There's no part of the brain that you can put an electrode on and make someone say 1 + 1 = 2. And there's no part of the brain where you can put an electrode and have someone say you should be kind to your neighbor. Moral law cannot be evoked from the brain, nor can reasoning be evoked from the brain. And the obvious explanation for that would be that while the brain, in some sense, is permissive for those things to be exercised in everyday life, they don't come from the brain. They're not brain things. They're spiritual things. Many other scientists have found analogous things in other aspects of neuroscience.
So you're talking about a distinction between brain and mind, right?
Brain and spirit.
Brain and spirit.
Yes.
Then what is the mind?
The mind is a collection of powers that the soul exercises. The mind basically is some of the things that the soul does. Again, the soul is defined as everything that makes us alive. If you want a kind of a real clear, simple definition of the soul, if you imagine everything that you are capable of doing when you're alive, minus everything that's true of your body when you're dead, the difference between the two is the soul. And the soul includes powers of memory, powers of emotion, powers of movement, and powers of perception. It also includes powers of intellect and powers of free will. And the powers of memory, emotion, movement, and perception are material powers of the soul. That is, they're in your brain. There's no question. Your ability to remember things depends critically on good brain function. However, the powers of reason and free will do not appear to be generated by the brain. They're powers of the soul. And our souls are composites of material powers, movement, perception, memory, and emotion, and immaterial powers, which is intellect and free will. And we are composite creatures.
So I've heard scientists say that they just haven't yet found the part of the brain where that stuff could be discerned.
Sure.
In terms of their experiments.
Yeah.
And two, that that what you're describing also cannot be measured, that you cannot measure a spiritual impact on the brain that causes a person to, let's say, have an epiphany or a Beethoven to come up with the Ninth Symphony. That's what you're talking about, right?
Well, you can certainly measure the Ninth Symphony. I mean, I mean, the music is written on paper and there's an enormous literature on Beethoven. So yes. The idea that this is something that you can't really analyze is, of course, nonsense. I mean,
you wouldn't be able to, when Beethoven was creating, which was an act of astonishing creativity, is that something that can or could not be measured in the brain, his creativity?
You cannot identify changes in brain state that are specific to spiritual events. You can find correlates in the brain to spiritual events, but those correlates are material things that that are happening. An easy way to understand that is imagine that you're studying for your calculus exam the next day. You're doing a whole series of things. Your soul is rather active with this because you've got this big test. One thing you're doing is you are writing out the equations on a piece of paper. That is soul activity. In a sense, it's movement. And the soul is one of the movement is one of the things the soul can do. And that comes from your brain. There's no question. You are looking at the textbook and you're reading it. And your ability to see the textbook is also a soul activity. It's vision. You are remembering by making images of, say, that the derivative of x squared is 2x in calculus. You're memorizing that in terms of memorizing the image. And so you are memorizing it. Also, your emotions matter a lot. You've got this big test the next day. So you're grinding it out, trying to make sure that you get the studying done. However, there are other things going on in your soul that are not going on in your brain. What's going on in your soul is that you're understanding what calculus means. You're getting the concept of calculus. The concept is not a brain thing. The concept is a spirit thing, a soul thing. It's a spirit thing. And you're exercising free will. That is, you're choosing to study for the exam. You could choose to just get drunk. But instead, you say, "Well, I've got to. I want to pass mathematics. I want to go on to be an engineer. So I got to study this stuff." So when you're studying calculus, it's your soul that's helping you do it. Your soul does two different things. It does the material things, the movement, the vision, the memory, and the emotion, and it does the spiritual things, which is conception, reasoning, things like that, and free will. So that's a nice way of thinking of it. And they work together, but they're not the same thing. Spirit and brain are not the same thing, but they do cooperate generally.
I've been noticing increasing advocacy against the concept of free will. The idea that we really don't have free will, we just think we do. And that some brain studies, and you know more about this than I do, have indicated that just before I move this pen, my brain has the stimulus that causes me to move the pen, so I really didn't choose to move the pen.
Right.
What do you say about that?
There are four reasons why free will is real, and free will is obviously real. The first reason is that everybody on the face of the earth believes it's real. Everybody. There's no human being who denies or has ever denied the reality of free will. By denied, I meant honestly didn't believe it. Belief is not simply a matter of what you say. Belief is what you do, how you live your life. The most free will denying materialist will get very, very angry at you if you deliberately walk over and pour your coffee on his laptop.
Yeah.
But if he's consistent, but if you don't have free will, then you have no control over whether you pour coffee on his laptop. It was just your brain that did it. You can't blame your brain. So every materialist, if you dent a materialist's fender in a parking lot and drive off, he'll be angry with you. But if he were a consistent materialist who denied free will, how could he be angry with you for driving off? You're no more responsible for denting his car than your car is. So the point is that everybody in their everyday life believes in free will. We all live that way. So materialists simply aren't being honest. They aren't having the introspection to say, yeah, you know, I live my life like free will is real. The second reason that free will is real is that if you deny that free will is real, what you're saying is that you are controlled by chemical processes in your brain. But chemical processes in your brain are not propositions. That is, they're not things that can be true or false. So what you're saying basically is I'm just a piece of meat with chemical reactions. So why would I pay any attention to whether you deny free will or you affirm free will? I don't listen to the opinion of meat. So a person who denies free will denies that they've freely chosen to use reason. The third reason is that people who deny free will deny it generally because they believe in determinism in physics. That is, that they believe that everything that happens is determined by the prior state of matter. But determinism has been unequivocally shown to be false, at least local determinism. There were three physicists several years ago who won the Nobel Prize for showing that determinism is false. So there's room for free will in nature. And the fourth reason is that there's quite a bit of neuroscience that supports the idea that free will is real.
What kind of, Denise, let me ask you this before I get to how they do that. You're both people of faith. You're very clear about that in the book. Did your faith bring you to your conclusions, or are your conclusions separate and apart from what your faith tells you?
I would find that very difficult to answer, because I don't know what, I'm 75 years of age. I don't know what I would think if I hadn't been a person of faith for most of my life. Now, okay, at the most basic level, I can't really answer it. But I can say that the processes of reasoning and research that, speaking for myself, I used were not based on any religious proposition. That is, I looked at what the evidence was showing, what the different people were saying, what we could infer, what we could definitely state. In other words, just as if I was writing an article on trucking problems in Ontario, which I used to do. So I don't think that I suddenly put on a little halo when I was working on this job. I treated it like any other situation where you have a fact base to try to explain to a lay audience. Oh, by the way, if I just may introduce one thing, Dr. Clauser, one of the three physicists to whom Mike referred, is going to be speaking at COSM this year.
Great.
In Scottsdale in November. Yes, Dr. Clauser.
As we're recording this, the Discovery Institute is hosting COSM next month, actually in November. This is the end of September that we're recording this. So a little free advertising on my podcast. So, Mike, I was very interested in your conversion story, that you started out as an atheist. And I believe when you got into medicine, you were still in that mindset, and then something happened. Why don't you describe that?
Right. Well, I had been raised in a secular environment, and I was never hostile to Christianity. I thought Christians were nice people, and I thought there were a lot of good things about it. I just didn't think it was true. I thought it was a fairy tale, and I began to have some doubts about my atheism as time went on. The birth of my children it's almost a miraculous feeling when you have a baby. I got involved a little bit with the Discovery Institute, and I came to see that Darwinism was a myth, wasn't true, and that intelligent design clearly was evident in nature. But what really transformed me was when my youngest son was born, we were concerned that he might be autistic. As a young baby, he wasn't making eye contact. He wasn't smiling. And so we brought him to a neurologist who said that we couldn't really be sure. So one night I was seeing a patient in consultation at a Catholic hospital, and I was having a lot of emotional stress because of my son. And after I'd seen the patient, I went into the chapel in the hospital, and I knelt down in front of the altar and I prayed to God. And I said, God, I don't know if you exist. I kind of doubt that you do, actually, but I'm kind of up against a wall here, and I can't take the idea that my son would be autistic, that he might not know me. He might not make an emotional connection to me. He might not love me. And I find that too much to bear. And God, I heard a voice, and the voice said very clearly, but that's what you're doing to me. And I collapsed in front of the altar, and I said, well, I won't do it to you anymore. I'm sorry. And please heal my son. So the next day, I called up the Catholic Church and said, I need to get baptized like now. And so they made me go through our RCIA. It actually took a few months. They had to kind of clean me up, and they're actually still working on it. So a couple of days later was my son's six-month birthday. And at the birthday party, he began smiling and making eye contact. It was a completely normal baby. So I promised God I wouldn't be autistic to him anymore. And that's the way I've been trying to live my life.
Well, now that considering that which I find interesting. It was almost like a St. Paul moment of being knocked off your horse. Yeah. We were talking earlier about how the soul animates the entire body, does all the biological functions, does the non-biological functions.
Right.
And you just brought up autism, and there's autism in my family. It kind of makes you wonder, well, if the soul does all of those things, how can there be autism?
Well, the soul, again, the soul is simply the properties that make you alive. So the soul can be ill. I mean, you can have, frankly, if you're having a heart attack, you're having a soul problem, because your soul makes your heartbeat, makes your heart work. And if it's not working right, then you're having a soul problem. So a person with with autism has a soul. There's no question about that. But they have an illness. They have a cognitive illness. The nature of the illness remains to be seen. I think of autism as a kind of a spiritual blindness, meaning that people are with autopsy, at least in the really severe cases of autopsy, are
autism.
Autism. In the really severe cases of autism, it's kind of a mind blindness. That is, that people are blind to other people's minds, so that they can only focus on concrete material things. And it's kind of a spiritual blindness in a way. And of course, there are many different versions of spiritual blindness. I think that autism is one of them.
Is a person with autism, their brain data, is it different than somebody without autism?
It's a good question. I'm not an expert on it. So my knowledge of it isn't as deep as I'd like it to be. There are unquestionably, obviously, differences in the way people function with autism, which points probably to some kind of brain issue. There are some statistical abnormalities in the brains of people who have autism, but I don't rigorously know that literature well, and I certainly don't think that the basis for autism has been established. We simply don't know what causes it.
So in the book, you write about certain things that have happened in the surgical suite that give rise to your thesis. You mm-hmm. talk about being able to just, for example, split the brain, but you can't split the mind. Describe what you mean by that.
So what happens with split brain surgery, there is a kind of epilepsy that can only really effectively be treated by cutting the connections between the two hemispheres of the brain, which stops the propagation of the seizure. It's called a corpus callosotomy. And it's an operation that's still done. It was done a lot decades ago. And these patients who've had their brain hemispheres disconnected have been studied extensively in neuroscience. And what's been found is that, first of all, they're essentially normal people. In everyday life, you can't tell the difference, even though the brain hemispheres are disconnected. With very careful testing, you can find perceptual issues, kind of subtle perceptual issues. For example, if you show an image to the right hemisphere, and there are ways of doing that using visual fields, the right hemisphere usually does not have the ability to speak. So you show an image to the right hemisphere, the person knows what the image is, but they can't say the word for it. Whereas if you show it to the left hemisphere, they can say the word for it. However, people with split brain surgery are able to match concepts between the hemispheres. For example, if you show a person who's had split brain surgery a picture of a violin in one hemisphere and pictures of an artist palette, a toilet plunger, and a stethoscope in the other hemisphere, and you ask the person, make a conceptual connection between the single picture and one of the other pictures. People with split brain surgery will, in a matter of seconds, say, oh, the violin is connected conceptually to the artist palette because they're both forms of art, music and art. The thing is, and if you think about it, it's quite remarkable. No part of that person's brain has seen both the violin and the artist palette. One hemisphere sees the violin, the other hemisphere sees the artist palette, but they can make the conceptual connection. So
when there's no biological connection between the hemispheres.
Precisely. Hemispheres are disconnected. So what is it that's making the connection? And of course, the answer is the human spirit. The spiritual part is not cut by the knife. So this phenomenon, which has been extensively studied, has been described by Yair Pinto, who's a prominent neuroscientist who studies split brain patients, as split perception and unified consciousness. That is, that there's an aspect of consciousness, of the mind, particularly spiritual powers, reason, conception, free will, that you can't split with a knife, which means it's not in the brain. But there are other parts of consciousness that you can split, and you can split perception, but you can't split reason. So reason isn't splittable. It's not in the brain.
So there's evidence there that there's a difference between pure brain function and perception, is what you're saying. And the scientist in you says that means that there's an immaterial aspect to the human person. Is that right?
Yes. There are aspects of the human person that you cannot split. You can't split reason. In fact, it's not even clear what that would mean to split reason, but you can't split it.
So if the materialists are correct, and if everything, you know, the materialists will say, well, the mind comes out of the brain. We just don't know how yet.
Well, I have an answer for that.
Yeah.
And it's because they always bring that up. I've debated it many times with them. And I have a simple answer. First, all of neuroscience points to the same thing, that there is an aspect of the mind that is spiritual that cannot be split. Every experiment that has been done in neuroscience relevant to that question has given the same answer. And there have been countless experiments. So yes, maybe something's hiding that we haven't seen yet, but it's been studied a lot over the past century. Second of all, I give them my phone number. And I say, when you have a shred of evidence to support the material origin of intellect and will, give me a call. But right now, you don't have the evidence. So right now, if you look at the evidence as it stands in 2025, there are aspects of the mind that don't come from the brain. That's what the evidence shows. Now, they have my phone number. If they find evidence for it, give me a buzz. Until then, they're wrong.
Denise, you've gone through, I'm assuming, a lot of the materials that Michael's talking about. Have you seen any evidence to contradict what he just said?
No. As a matter of fact, one of the funnier aspects of the science literature on this topic is Science Daily, Eureka Alert, and other centers that provide science media releases, presumably for a fee. They send them out to a vast variety of people, including yours truly, about findings in various sciences, and I tend to get the ones on neuroscience. And the recent buzz is that it turns out that the seat of consciousness is possibly the reptilian brain, which I think is the basal ganglia inside the brain. At least one neuroscientist did studies, and he said, that's where it is. And I thought, well, the crocodiles will be happy to know this. But I'm sure lots of people were wondering, are they as dumb as they look? Well, maybe not. Okay, wait a minute. I've heard this about that part of the brain. I've heard it about any number of other parts of the brain. I lose track. I can't keep up. All I know is that just as one such idea is fading, another one comes along. And I'm familiar with that kind of process, but not in situations where people are making real progress.
Yeah, it sounds like certain flailing. We desperately, to prove materialism, need to find where this emanates from in the brain itself, and we can't do it, so we keep picking different parts to say, that's it. Is that what's going on, Michael?
Yes. It's basically, I mean, it's some people have called it promissory materialism. That is that you keep promising that, hey, you know, Don't you worry your sweet little mind. Give us a couple years and we'll give you the answer. And I say, yeah, give me a call. But right now, there is no evidence that the intellect and will come from the brain. It's important to be clear about that the normal expression of intellect and free will depends upon the brain, but it doesn't mean that it comes from the brain. That is that the brain is necessary for me to study calculus. And yes. To understand calculus,
yes.
but it's not sufficient
in and of itself, because otherwise, then would the chimp that Denise was bringing up be able to study calculus?
Precisely. Chimps are analogous to human beings, except they do not have spirits. So chimps can, they have memory, they have emotion, they have movement, they have perception. They have all kinds of things, and some animals are much better at those things than we are. An eagle is a much better hunter than I am. I mean, they would do much, much better in the woods than I would, but they lack the capacity for intellect and will. That is, they don't have a moral law, and they lack the capacity for abstract reason. Animals.
We're talking about human exceptionalism here, and one of the aspects of human exceptionalism that I often emphasize is we're the only known truly moral species in the entire physical universe.
Absolutely. No other species has any kind of morality. Species may be kind. They may be good. My dog can be nice to me, but it's not based on morality. They don't base it on reason, on the Ten Commandments, on belief. They're just nice because they feel like being nice. Actually, Aristotle called that the sensitive appetite. That is, that you can have powerful emotions that have nothing to do with morality. And morality doesn't necessarily involve emotions.
Correct.
Morality can just be, it's wrong, you know?
Sometimes doing the right thing hurts more than doing the wrong thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, in fact, in some sense, the great moral struggle is to set your emotions aside in many cases and do the right thing, even if it hurts.
This is such a fascinating topic, and I'm beginning to run short on time, so I want to make sure I get to this. You focus on near-death experiences. Now, it used to be that NDEs were kind of thought of as not really true, and that it was all a myth, and people were making it up. But you and Denise write in the book that near-death experiences are real, and they tell us something. Explain that.
Near-death experiences are real in the sense that I think the evidence that they represent actual experiences beyond death for four reasons. First of all, they are very often crystal clear, highly organized. I mean, people have life reviews, which is not what happens when your brain is dying. That is, that's not a seizure. That's not a lack of oxygen to your brain. Those kind of problems cause us a muddling of thought. And thought in near-death experiences is usually much more clear than everyday life. The second reason is that people often have out-of-body experiences where they will see things around them that they could not have seen through ordinary physical means. That when their heart is stopped, when their brain isn't working, they can read ID badges and they know what goes on in the room around them.
They're seeing things but they're not looking through their eyes.
Correct. And the third reason is that when you look at the medical literature on near-death experiences, I'm unaware of a single report of meeting a friend or relative at the other end of the tunnel who's not dead. That is, that the people that you meet on the other end of the tunnel are always people who have predeceased you, even if you didn't know they were dead.
So if I had an NDE and my wife is in the room, I might see my wife in the room, but I wouldn't see her in the near-death experience aspect of whatever I'm visualizing or experiencing.
Precisely. Which is not the case, you would imagine, with wishful thinking, with hallucinations. There's no reason why a hallucination would only be somebody dead. It could be somebody alive. And there have been a number of instances of people who see people on the other end of the tunnel that they didn't know were dead. For example, there have been people in car accidents where there are multiple people in the car, and people were taken to different hospitals, and people passed away at other hospitals. And the person having the near-death experience in one hospital only sees the dead person at the other end of the tunnel, not the living people in the car who survived.
That's fascinating. Denise, how much literature is there on NDEs like that?
More than I would have thought, because an organization that studies NDEs got founded a couple of decades ago, and people started collecting stories. There are at least several papers in medical journals studying near-death experiences. There's, of course, the famous Pam Reynolds case, which was written up in a book, Sabom's. I can't think of the title just now, but has the word light in it. And
So what was that case, real quickly?
Well, very briefly, Pam Reynolds was a woman who had to undergo a very dramatic form of brain surgery in which she would have to be dead in the sense that all the blood was drained out of her brain. But her body was kept alive, of course, on artificial support in order to avoid her starting to decay, right? There's only one or two neurosurgeons in the world, I guess, who do this operation. Spetzler, the surgeon who worked on her, calls it standstill, where she's basically dead. Well, she had a near-death experience in which she was able to describe accurately a number of things that were happening in the surgical suite. And the interesting thing is her eyes were basically taped shut, and her ears had clickers in them that made noises in order to tell what was happening in her brain. So just how she managed to see and hear anything is not clear, except that she did have the near-death experiences. I remember in a documentary that was made about NDEs, they interviewed a young neurosurgeon who had been there. And he, when he first heard her start to talk about it, as he put it, he put the kibosh on the conversation because he was so shaken by hearing what she was saying. But later, as more people listened, they realized that she was accurately describing what was happening. Yet all the blood had been drained out of her brain. So how could this have been a natural means of discovering things?
So, Michael, if all the blood has been drained out of the brain, there can't be any conscious neural function, can there?
Precisely. I mean, all the blood being drained out of the brain is brain death. I mean, that's, yeah. It's, I mean, so she had complete awareness of events during the operation. She said she watched over the surgeon's shoulder, described the conversations in the room, described the instruments that he was using in great detail. She knew who was in the room. She knew what music was playing in the room. She went down a tunnel. She saw her dead relatives. They told her she had to come back. All of this is very well documented. And in fact, we call this whole thing the Pam Reynolds challenge. That is, that people who deny the reality of near-death experiences have to explain the characteristics of near-death experiences of the sort that Pam Reynolds had. And what was unique about her was that it was all almost like a scientific experiment, meaning she was deliberately put in a state of death. And then, of course, people with near-death experiences, usually it's not deliberate, it's kind of a disorganized, hectic situation. This was very carefully done. It was not hectic, carefully studied, and clearly she had a near-death experience where she experienced something profound after she was medically dead.
Did they keep her brain from deteriorating through cold or something?
Through cold. If the body temperature is lowered, the permanent death of body organs, including the brain, takes longer. And they had about 30 minutes. So what they did is they did the surgical approach to the aneurysm, got everything ready, and then stopped her heart. She was cooled down already to about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the surgeon drained the blood out of her brain by raising the head of the operating table. And he then opened the aneurysm, which normally he couldn't do because blood was flowing through it. Now that it was drained to blood, he could then sew it up and fix it quickly. And he had 30 minutes to do that. And at the end of 30 minutes, they then started her heart again and warmed her up and got her going again.
Well, that's very interesting, because if she wasn't brain dead in the sense that it was not irreversible.
Correct.
But her brain could not have been functioning at that time.
Could not have been. I mean, she and not only couldn't it have been, it was not, because they monitored her brain. That is,
It should have just been a blank for her, right? There should have been no conception of time, no conception of anything.
She was dead as a doornail. Dead as a doornail. You don't get any deader, at least reversibly. She was dead as a doornail, and proven to be so with extensive monitoring. There's no guesswork here. They monitored her brainwaves.
What is the lesson or the scientific hypothesis, let's say, that you gain from her and other near-death experiences that you write about?
That there is an aspect of the soul that survives bodily death. And we can't really say a lot more than that, meaning that there's so much mystery in what near-death experiences really mean. The theological implications are profound, and Denise and I are looking at that carefully and may do some future work on that.
I think that would be very fascinating to people because, as I said at the beginning when I did a bad Shakespeare, it's the ultimate question.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you think about it, all these lines of evidence, the fact that there are no intellectual seizures, that you can't stimulate intellect from the brain, that split brain surgery doesn't split the mind, that it appears that the spiritual aspects of the soul survive death, they all point to the same thing, which is that we have spiritual souls and our souls are immortal.
I was a little surprised to see an aspect of the book, a chapter on AI. What does AI have to, artificial intelligence, have to do with this?
Well, I wrote that chapter. The publisher asked for it because they wondered whether people would say, well, in the age of AI, won't all this be changed? Like if computers can do all the things that people can do. Maybe they have souls too, but then they're just machines, so et cetera, et cetera. You know, so, well, the short answer is computers can't do all the things people can do. And in that chapter, we try to point out, essentially, a computer can do anything you can represent by ones and zeros.
And
if that's how you can represent it, then you can program it in a computer. But if it's something that you can't represent by ones and zeros, then a computer can't and won't do it.
And you're saying that the human brain is not ones and zeros, it's something else.
It's definitely something else. Oddly, it does run on electricity, as computers do too. But that's where the resemblance ends, really.
So AI, and I've had a discussion with other of your other authors from Discovery Institute and transhumanists, AI will never become conscious. Michael, is that what you would say?
Yes. That's true. It will never become conscious. AI is the opposite of the mind. It's not simply that it won't become conscious. Is that what AI is the opposite of what the mind is. I say that because what AI is an algorithmic matching of a set of input, you know, physical input to physical output. A pattern of electrons are fed into a computer. The computer has a program, which is a set of rules that determine how the electrons exit the computer. There is no meaning in that process. It's free of meaning. Whereas the mind always has meaning. Every thought we have is about something. You can't have a thought that's not about something. So the computation is blind to meaning. Thought always has meaning. So computation is not only not thought, it's the opposite of thought. And in fact, it's the fact that computation does not have meaning that makes it so useful. Imagine, for example, if the computation that's going on right now in this podcast, in our computers, had meaning. Well, that would mean that the computer would have an opinion about what we're saying, and it might not let us say it. It might blank out the podcast. You can type essays, and you can type any opinion you want using a word processor. The word processor doesn't care what opinion you're expressing in the essay because computation is blind to meaning. It's much more useful to us because it's blind to meaning, but it's the opposite of thought.
But with AI and now, we've heard of the AI hallucinations and attempts to inhibit people from turning them off and this kind of thing. That, you're saying, is still just computation, right?
Yeah. AI is mass plagiarism. Everything in AI is things that people have put into the internet, put into the web. And AI simply is extremely effective, quick, and efficient at searching the web for these things, but it's all a process of computation. AI is us. AI is human beings in that are that have uploaded content into the web, and AI just puts that content together in a remarkably quick and effective way. But it's just us. There's only intelligence in AI is human intelligence that's fed into the web. The AI itself has no intelligence of its own.
And the programming of the AI would be
precisely.
Yeah,
precisely.
Yeah. I want to read a piece of your book. We're basically out of time, and I think it summarizes very well what you're doing. And then I'd like to have a couple of closing questions. This is on page 190. This is at the heart of the mystery I discovered in surgery and in learning and contemplation about the mind and brain. We are hybrids, composites of spirit and matter, with souls that bridge the spiritual world and the material world. We are mineral in our bones, vegetable in our growth and nourishment, animal in our movement and sensations, and spiritual in our reason and free will. We humans embody all elements of creation. That is beautifully written, and it seems to me that the ultimate message of your book is hope.
Yes, it's an ancient insight of these great scholastic philosophers, and I think it's a very beautiful insight, that we are the only thing in creation that bridges spirit, matter, and mineral. Spirit, living things, and mineral. That is that we have minerals in our bones, we have flesh in our bodies, and we have spirits in our soul. And we really are an amalgam of everything in creation, and it is our spiritual nature by which we are created in God's image.
And once we accept that we are more than just carbon molecules, then it seems to me that it is part of the human condition to seek truth as to what all of that means. And that is not the job of science, is it? That's the job of faith or philosophy.
Yes, yes. But frankly, I mean, science ought to be seeking the truth as well. And the fact is that our spiritual nature is part of the truth about us. And any science that does not recognize that is junk science.
So we can say that science can demonstrate, or at least there's evidence for, a spiritual aspect to human life and human existence.
Well, of course. And if it can't do it, it's bad. It's bad science. It's bad because that's the truth.
But it can't say, for example, it can't demonstrate that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and so forth.
Well, certainly that's a bit of a reach. I mean, it's been the traditional Christian view that there are truths about God that can be proven by nature, that's natural theology, and that there are truths about God that can only be shown through faith and through scripture, and that's revealed theology. And I think that's true.
But I think the Buddhists could also gain something from this, because the Buddhist believes in reincarnation, that although I'm not sure they believe in a spirit, since it's a non-theistic approach, but they would say, okay, yes, we believe that life continues after death, too. It just gets redirected into a new life.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they're right. There are various ways of understanding this. I think the Christian way is the way that is most consistent with science and with the truth. But yes, the different spiritual traditions have different ways of understanding this.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I find this very interesting, this whole idea of the distinction between mind and brain, soul and material aspects of our biological beings and so forth. So let me ask you, what next for Michael and Denise?
Well, we are in discussion with a publisher about a book on near-death experiences seen from a scientific perspective. But of course, when we use the term scientific perspective, we mean more or less what Mike is talking about. Science, what the data shows in relation to the reality that human beings are, as he says, a hybrid of spiritual and material realities, both living and dead. Because that's what we actually experience. Most of the sort of science that's out there trying to disprove the existence of the mind, of free will, of near-death experiences, or whatever it is they're trying to otherwise disprove the existence of, is simply attempting to define away or explain away things that we live and take for granted every day. So that's not what we're doing. We want to incorporate a science approach to the whole experience.
And Mike, you're obviously interested in that project if it goes forward, and also still doing your teaching and your surgeries?
Yes. And research. I'm very much involved in research on blood and spinal fluid flow in the brain. I got a lot of things going on, but this absolutely fascinates me, and I'm passionate about letting the public know that there is a scientifically demonstrable spiritual aspect to human beings. It's part of the truth of who we are, and good science makes it clear that that's the case.
Very interesting, because people might claim, well, because you have faith, you're committed to this answer. But the same thing could be said of materialists. They're so committed to their worldview that they don't want to see where the evidence takes it.
Yeah, there's not a shred of my faith in the scientific argument that I'm making. The scientific argument I'm making is based on evidence, and the evidence is crystal clear, and it's not me who's denying the evidence. That is, that I accept the evidence as it is, which points to the spiritual nature of the human soul. Materialists are the ones who say, oh yeah, but you know, we'll show sometime in the future that we're right. And as I say, you got my phone number.
That's the materialism of the gaps, you might say.
Absolutely. And there is a massive gap.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show. It was a very interesting discussion. And again, for people who want to read the book, which I recommend because I've read it, it was a fascinating read. The Immortal Mind, A Neurosurgeon's Case for the Existence of the Soul by Dr. Michael Egnor and Denise O'Leary. Thank you both for being on Humanize.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wesley. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.